Were I to ask you to name a famous outlaw, you would likely say Robin Hood. But things have changed greatly since his day. And the lines between those within the law and those without the law have narrowed in our time to double yellow or broken white. And a decree of the Sheriff of Nottingham nailed to a tree in Sherwood Forest carries a lot less clout than a parking ticket wedged between your windscreen and your wiper. And with each generation, new names are woven into the social fabric. I mean, take Instant Maxwell, and you all know what that was like. Or, as someone said the other day, I have got an original Adams. Someone said, a fireplace. No, no, he said, a summons for speeding at Antrim. I suppose our most famous in-law turned outlaw was Sir Roger Casement. When he was in-law, he was knighted by the British government for his expose of the treatment by Belgian colonials of the people of Putnamea in South America. But the people of his own country, apart from ex-classmates at Ballymena Academy, knew little about him. When he became outlaw, his name was household from Red Bay Strand in the Glens of Antrim to fateful Bannerstrand in Kerry. But the odd thing was, trying to find someone among the ordinary people who had ever met this enigmatic rebel. So you'll imagine my delight when going to record a very old man in the Glens of Antrim. His niece told me he talked to Casement. What? I decided to keep the Casement cask to the finish and let him feed on of his native wines for reminiscence. And then I asked him quite pointedly, did he ever remember any famous person at the first big fish in the Glen on 1904? He came back immediately. Roger Casement was there. Oh, I said, did you see him? Did I see him? I met him and talked to him. Oh, do you remember what you talked about? As well as a man, what we're talking about now. And where did you meet him? I met him miss down at Miss Ada McNeil's of Cushing Dun. Now, that was a nice, because it was whispered that Casement and Miss Ada, sister of Lord Cushing Dun, were more than just friends. Were you visiting Miss Ada? What the hell would the likes of me be visiting Miss Ada for? I was down with Don Ryan putting coals into her. Oh, I see. Well, how did you come to meet Casement? Well, when we had the coals up in the shade, Ryan says you better go round and tell her them coals is there. So I went to the door and I napped. And he come to the door. Who came to the door? Roger Casement come to the door. Yes. I said to him, tell Miss Ada them coals is there. Yes. He said, right. Yes, I said. Well, that was it, he said. That was it. You see, no one had ever asked the old man what he and Casement talked about. Why? Let me tell you. Back in the 1890s, he had been to college in Belfast for 2 years and come back to his glen with the name of being a bit of a scholar. In an enclave like the Glens, people don't question their scholars. They dance attendance on them. And I had a perfect example of that one day, coming from Kilrea Petty Sessions and popping in for pop to the Brown Trout with my friend Nixon Logue, a stout man at court or counter. And it was packed. It was packed with English reps holding sherries and holding forth. And into the middle of them came this ragged man with a tattered overcoat, a belt of binder twine. I thought, a Bill and Ann establishment, and this chap, well, well, let's see the fun. Nixon and I waited. A waitress spotted him and came through, and we listened as she said, are you getting, John? Oh, not yet, daughter, but when it's handy for you, pint. Set you up to the fire, John, now it's a cold day. Who was this man? He was John Mullen, and an Achadui and district. He was the man, if you were seeking a job in London or Dublin or Belfast or Glasgow, he was the man writ the letter. You see? He was her scholar, he was her scribe, and that cutty was dancing attendance on him. And when she eventually got round to us, she said to Luke, are you getting? Yes, he said, impatient. Of course, One doesn't have to take up arms to rebel, as Kissmann did. Take the Orr Owens incident. Orr Owens was a latter-day landlord. He's commemorated to this day by an orange hall on the Dough to Bellamina Road. And he made it a rule, a local law, shall we say, that on gale days, when you came to his premises to pay rents, you weren't allowed to smoke. So down the years, as Orr Owens sat puffing his pipe contentedly in the booth, men hung about in the yard dying for a reek. Until one day he looked out to call next and saw a man stuffing tobacco into his pipe and going for the lucifers. "Robert James," he said. "Yes, Mr. Owens, you know the rule, only one man allowed to smoke." "That's right, Mr. Owens. So put yours out, for I'm for lecting up." The law was never enforced again. It's not surprising in the light of that story that it was from that part of South Antrim, the most vigorous agrarian organisation in the history of Ulster, in my opinion, the Hearts of Steel sprang. Just before the 98 rebellion, a deputation from a lodge of the Hearts of Steel came to the Moravian settlement at Grace Hill to tell them, "We're going to burn you out." "Why," they said, "you're land grabbers, that's what you're going to be burned out." "But wait a minute, we paid for this place." "Where's your proof?" "Well, we'd have to send to Dublin for the deed." "Well, you have 1 week to get it, and if it's not here, it's the torch." They dispatched a horseman to Dublin, and in a week's time, the deputation was back and saw the deed. "By God, boys, you did pay. You bloody did pay through the bloody nose. We'll make you this promise. There'll not be a shot fired in this village." And there wasn't. Throughout the 98 rebellion, that was the one neutral place in County Antrim, and to it, refugees from Ballymena flocked for protection. 165 years on, a man called Kennedy took an action for trespass at Ballymena County Court before Judge David Little against an angling club who were on his land in pursuit of fish. The club came to court armed with an agreement from the estate office at Randallstown granting them the fishing rights through Kennedy's land. So what was the old fella talking about? Then he produced his title. And the root of his title was that deed the Moravians showed the horseman all those years before. And what had been forgotten in the dusts of time was that when the Moravians paid through the bloody nose, they also bought the fishing rights. They were no longer in the patronage of the O'Neills. Judge Little said, "I award this man a decree for £25. Old Kennedy interposed, your honour, you give the money to the charity of your choice. I simply wanted my Lord O'Neill to know he doesn't own everything in the county of Antrim." Yes. Paddy McCafferty of Glenariff was a man who had no time whatever for fishing rights. In his day, 50, 60 years ago, he was the best tickler of salmon in the glens of Antrim. And on the day, or the night before the day I want you to meet him, he had been to awaken Glendun. And as he said himself, every step of the tar road hurt his head. So he took to the sand loanin and down to the river. "Aye, that's better. And then I saw me fish in beside a sally bush. And I remembered there was a big head constable staying in his holidays over at the end of the bay, was mad keen for a salmon. There was £10 or £12 in this fella, and says I to myself, head constable, you have got yourself a fish. I was making ready to take him when, oh God, oh God, I seen the cap of down the bale of Bob and above the ones two bends of the river away. Oh God, oh God, there was nothing else for it. I had to take a heart attack. So I lay down on the brew and watched him out of the corner of my eye as he come up. Lord God, but he was a bad walker, hirpling all the way. He dropped on a knee beside me. I thought he was going to say the prayers for the dead, but he was listening for my heart. Says I, not yet, Dan. Paddy," he says, "what are we going to do?" "Dan, you're going to put your hand into my pocket and draw out whatever silver you can get. Lord, it's a very odd thing to feel another man hooking in your pocket for your money. What'll I do now, Paddy? You'll run down. You'll run with that silver down to wee Collins in the village. And you'll get whatever brandy money could buy. Oh, but Paddy, dare I leave you? That's the risk you'll have to take. Run. Now, I knowed if he ran, he'd be picked before he went a handful of paces. And by the time he got to the village, he would hardly have the breath left to tell. So I got out my fish, wrapped him in reeds, and had him in at the back of a thorn bush before I saw his cap bobbing again above the winds, and I resumed my heart attack. Well, he come up, and he gathered my head in his arms the way a mother would a wean, and he put the bottle to my lips. I wasn't used to taking it that way, and I dribbled. Says I, Dan, set me up and I'll feed myself. So I had two or three gulps in the bottle and corked it against better times. Now to get him away from that fish. Dan, says I, in case I take another wee turn, would you ever oxter cog me down to the village? Surely to God, Paddy. You see, I knowed if I got him to the village, he'd spend the rest of the day telling all and sundry how he saved my life. So we got up, and every bit of the way he would say to me, wasn't that a mercy to God, Paddy, I come on you this day? It was, Dan, it was a mercy to God. Sadly, years later, there was no mercy and no one to save poor Dan's life when young burglars killed him in search of his own silver. There was in Waterford at that time a bona fide fisherman, there was probably another one, called Willie Shan McCauley. Willie fished in Red Bay, you would have seen him out there on the boat with his dog, Rover, in the stern. And one night, as Willie Shan said, in an innocent incident, the dog allegedly bit a policeman. A summons followed. Poor Willie Shan couldn't read. He took it to Dan Ryan, who pronounced that a lawyer would have to be chartered for this one. For you have to be at Cushendall Court to show cause why your dog should not be destroyed or kept under proper control. So the day of the law came. Dan and Willie Shan and Rover. And Rover fell asleep between the solicitor and the district inspector, a man the name of Halfie out of Larne, I remember. Bored stiff, I suppose, the poor animal was. And after the police case closed, the magistrate, a man under the delightful name of Puck McWilliam, asked, are you calling any evidence? The lawyer said, yes, I'm calling the dog. And for the first time, as I understand it in legal history, an animal got up to give evidence on its own behalf, though it wasn't sworn. Walking over solicitors' books and papers and this sort of thing. And old Puck said, that's a lovely wee dog. And at that moment of time, the dog licked the lawyer's hand. And Puck said, that clinches it for me. I could not condemn any creature so trustingly innocent as to lick the hand of a Bellamina solicitor. Case dismissed. If Willie Shan's dog got him into trouble and then out of it again, let me tell you about a young fellow from these parts who ended up in double trouble, mitching school and attending an illegal horse race meeting. Everybody called him Matha. Well, nearly everybody. So when somebody called out, Matthew, cut of all places, Red Bay flapper races, he never bothered. But when the voice called again, Matthew, it registered. And he turned slowly to see his clergyman from home standing on the dike beckoning to him. Fine day, Matthew. Yes, sir. Father with you today? No, sir. Here alone, Matthew? Yes, sir. School today, Matthew? Yes, sir. Huh? Playing truant boy? Playing what, sir? Mitching, Matthew? Yes, sir. No place for a 12-year-old boy to be in his own. Come and join my wife and myself. We're picnicking out along the commons. Martha followed him along the commons that fringe Red Bay Strand, leaving behind the crowds and the noise, the bookies, the card trick men, the roulette men, the Maggie men, but worst of all, the horses and the riders. Because Martha, young as he was, had ridden against the very best of them. They found the picnic place in a clearing in the winds and were just settling down when the horses came thundering past in a race, sand flying, turning at a flag and galloping madly back to the finish down at the back of Waterfoot. After a couple of races, a man came out of the crowd and came up along the water's edge, scanning the commons, and came to the point just opposite the picnic place. Stood, looked, came up from the wet sand through the dry and says, "Is that you, young Martha?" "It is, Mr. Gillian. Would you ride me horse for me?" The minister intervened. "Just one moment," he said. "I'm in charge of Matthew today. What's your name, sir?" "The name's Gillian, sir, from Grace Hill, Stirnocum. And I would like Matthew to ride Prince James." "What will you pay him?" "A sovereign. Win or lose?" "Win or lose." "You'll pay him now?" "Very well, sir." And he tossed the sovereign through the air, and Martha plucked it out of the sun. "Matthew," said the minister, "go and ride the man's horse. I'll hold the sovereign till you come back, and you will come back for the sovereign." Martha won the race and returned for, as the minister put it, extra lemonade for our hero, my dear. "Matthew," he said, "there's your sovereign. Tell no man that you have it. And when the long car stops, as it will, at every stand and dram from here to Ballymena, don't you get down from the car, Matthew." Well, it did stop so often that it was dusk when he got home. And his father made at him across the yard with a stick race. "Where the hell were you, boy?" "Waterford races. What? Dad, look what I won." And he held out his palm with his sovereign in the middle. The father picked it up between finger and thumb and said, "Martha, you should say before you go to places like that. You should say, Martha, you should say." Yes. The Martha in that story was an uncle of my late, and the late lamented friend of so many of us, Jim Bammer. The name Bammer forever associated with horses all over the world, but particularly here in North Antrim. I remember Jim being asked about two horse dealers who were warned off Dublin Horse Show for fiddling with a horse which they were trying to sell to an American lady. And Jim was asked, did he know them? "Did I know them?" he said. "Young pair of boys," he said, "would have done anything to sell you a horse. Do you know something? If you had given them the specifications, I think they could have made you a wee horse." That uncle of Jim's, Martha, and Jim's father, Johnny Bammer, were cattle dealers together. And at that same time, a legendary lawyer from Marifelt, Lawrence Hastings, was doing a bit of cattle dealing himself. And he was telling me, "You know, young McCann, if you get up early enough, there were men coming in with bastes from a place called The Rock, hungry as it sounds, and there was a room for a bit of improvement on them if you get out early enough." Well, he says, "I went out at 8 only to find a pair of boys from Ballymena, the name of Bammer and Simpson, had been there at 7:30. "Right," says I. "The next fair day I was there at 7:00, only to find Bammer and Simpson were there at 6:30. "Aye, well, they're not beat me," says I, "and I went to 6:00 only to find they were there at 5:30. "Ah, well," says I, "if you want it that bad, you can keep it." Yes. That sort of roadside dealing ended, of course, with the sales rings. That kind of thing where men would have sold their cattle and be home maybe 3 or 4 hours even before the fair in the town began. And I can picture a man the name of Hennessy, a guinea hunter, the man who made deals on the road or in the hill, the man who got the guinea, as they say, for making the deal. And there he is at the opening of one of these rings in the south of Ireland, leaning on the rail and hearing the parish priest outlaw him, saying, "We have gathered here today to open to new sales ring. You will now see an end to this barbaric business of slapping of hands and of backs in the dark of the road or the light of a swinging hurricane lamp, and a man going home to his wife and children with a wad of wet notes in his hand, not knowing what he has. You will bring your animals in here to God's daylight. You'll see them sold before your very eyes, and at the end of it you will receive a check, less the charges, from the mart, which you will take home to your wife. An end forever to those barbaric customs that have so defaced our community." He didn't know, I'm sure, that he was also putting an end to a very, very good source of litigation, breaches of warranty in the sales of cows that graced every county court for a lifetime. But Hennessy knew what was happening. And when he met the clergyman about 6 weeks later and heard him say, "Hennessy, I was looking at the Easter collection, I don't think I saw your name." "No, you did not, Father. You did not. I'm like yourself. I'm cutting out the middleman." I suppose it could be said that potching makers cut out the middleman. I mean, it's straight from the still to the stomach, as it were. And I want you to look at a potching maker, Cunningham, who lived in the hill of lead above Cushendall. I want you to see him through the eyes of two people, a poet and a policeman. The poet, John Hewitt, he saw Cunningham, the potching maker, surviving in folk memory long after the policeman had gone on his way. And in his poem, Folk Custom, he tells us, "Our foolish neighbour, further up the hill, already twice before the bench, has earned more trouble with his private still. He wore a pad too, like a well-trod lane, running his neck into law's ready noose. He only made potching for table use." It would have been something if he had flashed the stuff at every killie round the countryside, and from the eager orders earned enough to pay his debts or gain a second bride. Ah, but he had no more wit nor more to do than stretch on Sundays full along the brew. No, it's not his misdemeanor that affronts. Sure, we all have careless follies to confess. Be up before the petty sessions once, and not a man would rate to hit the less. It's that we know of smarter men that rot and still in all their days were never caught. But the policeman would have none of it. "Your Worship," he said, "as a result of information received, I obtained a search warrant and proceeded with it to the hill of Lead north of Cushendall, where the defendant lives alone. As I approached his place, Your Worship, I noticed empty treacle tins at the back of ditches, and I observed, Your Worship, that the closer I got to the house, the greater became the number of these treacle tins. Till in the yard, Your Worship, against the gable wall, there was a pile of them as big as a turf stack. I knocked the door, Your Worship. The defendant answered it. He seemed surprised to see me and said, 'What do you want?' I said, 'I have a warrant to search your place.' 'For what?' he said. 'Potting,' said I. 'I have reason to believe you are making potting.' 'Me,' he said. 'Potting, me.' I took that to be a denial, Your Worship." And I said to him, "If you are not making potting, can you explain all those empty treacle tins about your place?" He replied, "Your Worship, I don't like jam." We all have careless follies to confess. most of them in motor cars. Like the man from the Glens before the bench in Ballymena, for an accident arising out of coming over a halt line up the Killary Road. The magistrate said to him, "Tell me," he said, "did you not see the white lines?" "Oh, I did, your worship, I did." "Why did you not stop?" "Well, tell you the truth, your worship, I thought them white lines was only for learners." Well, no learner was the old lag before Judge Marcus Dill Begley. He had a record as long as today and tomorrow. And Marcus had a habit before he put a man down of sucking his teeth. And there he was, sucking his teeth, having a look at the record and then having a look at his man. "Do you know something, friend?" he said. "What's that, Your Honour?" "I don't think we're going to be seeing each other for a long, long, long time." "Jesus, Judge, don't tell us you're leaving." Well, I'm leaving you for a short time, and I'll see you again after the break. Thank you very much. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed yourself during the break, that you have no complaints, unlike the farmer in the pub in North Antrim on a fair day years ago. He called 12 whiskies. "We drop a war." And after tasting and talking for a while, turned to the public and says, "Hey, boy, tell us something. What did you put in there first, the water or the whiskey?" "The whiskey, of course." "Well, that's not so bad. We could come on it yet." I suppose from time immemorial, man has complained about water in his drink. G.K. Chesterton wrote, "And Noah, he often said to his wife, as he sat down to dine, 'I don't care where the water goes, if it doesn't get on the wine.'" Let's keep to the literary line for a little longer. Hewitt, Chesterton, and remember that it was Sergeant Dan Connell of Cushendall that saved Chesterton's life. It was back in 1932, on a summer afternoon, he spied the writer in the village and saw that he was accompanied by a priest who was also a rabid advocate of temperance. He appreciated poor Chesterton's dilemma, because he was a bookish sergeant, as opposed to one who would book you. And he immediately spotted that poor Chesterton was caught between the closed mind and the closed shop, the pub, as it were. So he invited both men to his house, where his good wife Mimi made tea for the priest, while he and Chesterton opened a bottle of bush. Chesterton raised his glass and said, "Sergeant Connell, you have saved my life. This pussyfooting priest would have drowned me in tea ere dusk." Yes, to continue the literary line, Charles Kingsley. "I know of only one member of the Northern Bar who ever used poetry to woo a jury, the late James McSparren, the greatest advocate of his day. He took Kingsley's poem, Young and Old, in a case in the High Court for a footballer who had lost a leg, using it to stress the point that when they made their award, it was once and for all." You know the poem. "When all the world is young, lad, and all the trees are green, and every goose a swan, lad, and every lass a queen." And then over to the next verse. "When all the world is old, lad, and all the trees are brown," and he came to the piece, "Creep home, and take your place there, the spent and maimed among. And a man in that Belfast jury wept. The jury made the client an award of £25,000, a fortune in those far off days. I remember James talking to a jury, that was his great strength, talking to a jury in Armagh at the Winter Assize, and putting to them the question, and I ask you, members of the jury, would he or would he not? Little man in the middle of the front row of the jury answered him. No, he says he wouldn't. And that, of course, was that. Withal, James never became case-hardened, never lost the common touch, as witness his own beautiful poem, The Grace of an Easy Mind, and always understood that for many people, going to law or being taken to law was as traumatic an experience as going for major surgery. We're sometimes inclined to forget that. I got a very early lesson in this. I remember just out of college in my father's office, sitting in on a consultation for a title case at Ballymena Quarter Sessions, when the telephone rang and my father answered it. Hello, Sam. It was Sam Cumming, my second father, and on that day, solicitor for the defense. They talked together, and my father put the earpiece back on the hook and said, no need to go to the court today, gentlemen. Why is that? The defendant hanged himself last night over blocking a right-of-way. Poor, poor man. Poor, poor man. He saw words as weapons, the parry and the thrust, and he sought sanctuary in the silence of death. Not so one of the brothers Brown, solicitors Marifelt, at Marifelt Quarter Sessions before the then Recorder of Londonderry, making a point which did not meet with the approval of the Recorder, who told him to sit down. Brown stood on. Sit down, said the judge. Brown stood on. With that, the judge said, it would fit you better, Mr. Brown, instead of standing there stubborn, if you had paid me for some of the briefs I did for you at the bar. What, said Brown, what? Paying you were for every one, and now that I have a chance to tell you, damn poor value. The judge roared, arrest that man for contempt, and stormed off the bench. Brown darted in under the solicitor's table in Marifelt, and the sergeant came up and said, Mr. Brown, come out. No, Sergeant, I am claiming sanctuary. But, Sergeant, you heard what His Honour said. Never mind what His Honour said, Sergeant. I am claiming sanctuary, and if you lay a hand upon me, may it wither to the wrist. For a sanctuary, Sergeant, is sacred. In the meantime, members of the bar had gone round to the judge's room to remonstrate with him. One senior member saying the most disgraceful episode, but the judge explaining that he was provoked, and they saying, no, come on round and resume the hearing and let this thing die decently. And he agreed. They came round and said to the sergeant, that's all right, Sergeant. Brown, you can come out now. It's all's well. Brown dusted himself off, come in. The tipstaff said, all stand. Court resumed. This court of quarter session is now open. And the judge said, you were saying, Mr. Brown. I suppose 400 years ago, John Sinden was saying, a king is a thing made by men for their own sakes. And I once, for that very reason, crowned a man king. I was appearing for Mick Michaelhatton at Clochmill's Petty Sessions and thought a touch of the royals might save the day. So I made him there and then the King of the Glens and pleaded with the resident magistrate to spare the king. Sadly, it was Jack Fox, who's Jewish, And being Jewish, his royal line went away back to the house of David. And an upstart king from North Antrim was of no account whatever. He gave him 4 months. He gave him 4 months. Mick refused to appeal. And Garrett McGrath was asked to approach the then Minister of Home Affairs, Brian McConnell, about this dreadful business. And the minister ordered Michael Hatton's early release on the basis that it was quite wrong to have a kingly craftsman languishing among common criminals. When Mick got out, I asked him, "How did you get on, Mick?" "Oh, the very best," he said. I was in the kitchen, and if they were paying the slightest attention to what I was saying, they should be making it in yonder for Christmas. Strangely, it was cooking that formed for Michael Hatton, indeed formed for many, the most wonderful friendship between an in-law and an outlaw that I have ever known. Michael Hatton was 2.5 years on the prison ship, the Argenta in Larne Loch, and the commandant of the specials on the boat was the son of the founder of the Gallagher cigarette empire. And Mick and he became firm friends from the day that Gallagher came in with a hare he had shot above Garn Point, and Mick showed him how to cook it. After Mick was released, Gallagher had the shooting rights of that mountain in Glenarriff, and he and Mick shot it together. Although Mick said he always made him walk 2 paces ahead of him. I suppose on the basis that nobody can ever be 100% sure. But at the end of the day, it all came out. In his will, Gallagher left Mick Michael Hatton 750 quid. A princely, no, what shall we call it? A kingly sum. Indeed. I suppose the most interesting will, indeed the most amazing will ever admitted to probate was in America. Well, didn't it have to be? The testator was a little meek man who had married a widow. And she, in spiritualism, spent the rest of his life attempting to make contact with her dearly beloved first husband. Well, when you get a lifetime of that, you die, as the little man did, and she went to see the attorney. Did he make a will? Make a will? He sure did. Yes. Could I hear it? You sure could. Because he made it on a gramophone record. And after the preliminaries, heard his voice saying, "And this really is the voice of your late unlamented second husband. All my earthly goods I've realized in dollars, which I've placed in a steel box and buried deep in the bowels of the earth. And if your first husband's half as clever as you think he is, he'll tell you where to find it." There was, in the glens of Antrim, down, in fact, where Cushendall Golf Club now is, a woman with 2 husbands, alive and legally her husbands at the same time. The first man was a sailor man, and after a number of voyages, he went off on one occasion and never came back. Never was heard of again, not a letter, not a sound, nothing. So a farmer had an eye for her and she for him, and she went to Dublin in those days to ask for an order, presuming her husband dead. And that was granted. And she and the farmer married and got on very well. Until one fair day, she saw coming down yon lane, where it is to the pair of them. My God, the 2 husbands. And in they came. She said, "I thought you were... Look, I'll tell you what," she said. "Go up to the room and leave your hats there in the hall stand till I think this thing over, for you both can't stay." They both agreed. "When I knock the door and you come up again, I'll give the hat to the man who has to go." And they both agreed. They went down to the room, she to the kitchen. She pondered her problem, wondered, And up in the room, they talked about the fine woman she was. And then the knock on the door. And out in the hall, she handed the seaman his hat. And he walked out of her life and out of Cushendall forever. And that's a true story. Now, going to sea, of course, was traditional in the Glens. And I first met Paddy Mack at college in Belfast, where in those days, you could hear the boats blowing in Belfast Lough, and he would say, "Jack, do you hear? Oh, I wish I was going." Well, he hadn't any great academic career. Next time I saw him, he was still dreaming. There's a schooner in the offing and her topsail shot with fire, and my heart has gone aboard her for the islands of desire. But he ended up selling agricultural oil around the glens of Antwerp. And one evening he parked the van outside the upper hotel, and there at the counter was the skipper of a puffer that was putting off coal at Red Bay before going up to Coleraine to pick up pit props. And before you could say puffer, the skipper and Paddy Mack fell to the drinking. And before you could say it again, they're in the agricultural oil van driving out to the pier with a bottle of Bush and a case of Guinness rattling behind them. They locked the van and Paddy Mack went aboard. His dream had come true. He was going to sea. Round the world with Marna, that's the life for me. And they went past such exotic places as Cushendun and Bushmills and Port Ballantrae and Port Rush before they dropped anchor in Port Stewart Bay waiting for the pilot to come down the van. And as the pilot took them up the van, bobbing to the sea was an empty Bush bottle and an empty Guinness case. Paddy Mack said his goodbyes, hired a taxi, went back to the Glens, opened the van, and went on selling agricultural oil. But people noticed a subtle change in the man. He didn't stop anymore. He anchored. And he didn't pull up. He hove to. And he never went in for a drink. He came alongside for fuel. And was heard to shout belay in the midst of an argument and threatened to use a marlin spike. It was his dear sister Nora who finished the story for me. She said, while after that we were bagging potatoes at home because they lived in the 10th Glen, Glenravel. And we had a man down from Skerry Rock that hadn't seen a bus, she said, helping Paddy. And I went out to call him and I heard Paddy talking and appeared through a crack in the door. And there he was, lying back in the sacks, sucking on a fag in the scary man's eyes out there. And Paddy's saying, "Oh, but Christ, boy, you should have seen the women in Madagascar." You may ask me, how did he get into in-laws and outlaws? Well, he had all the hallmarks of an outlaw, but he ended up a tipstaff at the Old Bailey. I only knew of one tipstaff who became a judge, and his hold on the job was tenuous in the extreme. His name was Preston, and he was the tipstaff for Judge Bates in the county of Antrim. Bates was a man who dined at 8 and therefore had very little at lunchtime and used to dispatch Preston for apples. Preston went to a shop near the courthouse in Ballymena, Miss Todd's, where he bought the judge's apples down the years. Then, of course, as is inevitable, Preston fell ill, and poor Bates had to don his coat and go searching for Miss Todd's. Found it and asked, "Is this where the judge gets his apples?" "Oh, dear me, yes. Is he ill that he couldn't come himself today?" There he was, wearing two hats. I have mentioned Judge Bates and Judge Begley and Judge Little. And I'd feel remiss if I didn't mention that dear man, Judge Isaac Copeland, and recall a day when a clergyman was making, well, a special plea on behalf of a bad boy and saying to him, "Your Honour, I think he's worth a chance." Isaac looked at him. "Reverend sir," he said, "look you to his spiritual welfare and leave the temporal punishment to me, if you don't mind." I feel myself that I would again be remiss if I didn't mention those men who sit between the bench and the bar, the clerks of court, not only because they have been so helpful and kind to me, but because my father, over 80 years ago, acted as deputy clerk of petty sessions here and there, and told me of being provided with a pony and trap to go to Port Glenone Court when a wayward man of those days, whom many of the older men would know, a solicitor in Bradley, said, "John P., could you give me a lift?" Out they went, and in McLaughlin's hotel yard, the pony and trap set up, and my father saw Bradley climb up on a loose box and grab two handfuls of horse hair out of a bag above the stable where it used to be stored in those days. The court went on, my father told me, till evening when the light at the oil lamp. And in those days, there were civil cases where neighbour prosecuted neighbour. And this was an assault case on a cross assault. And he said, sitting there between the bench and the bar, and of course, as the clerks know, not saying a word, he heard Bradley saying, "I put it to you, you pulled my client's hair." "Never," she said. "Where," says he, pulling the horse hair out, "did that come from?" "I don't know," she said. "You don't?" "Well, there it is again, and I'll give you another chance to tell his worship here. Where then did that come from if you didn't pull her hair?" And he thrust it in again. The magistrate dismissed the summons against his client and was about to send the other one to jail when Bradley realised he had gone a bit far and said, "No, no, your worship, please. We just want peace. We just want peace." Now, again, when I think of it, I would like to tell you two throwaway stories, shall we say, about the solicitor and client relationship, and I use the word throwaway advisedly. It was Harry Hall who said of the payment of fees, "More dangerous than the petrol bomber is the fellow who says to you, 'I'll throw them in till you, Harry.'" But my mother was a very quiet gentlewoman, and just as a young bride on the Brishin Road, father and she had set up house and found that a part of the lawn at the side of the house with a downpipe was getting soggy, and my father asked an old gentleman called Hatton would he cut some sods and put them in to lay it again. At lunchtime one day, old Hatton arrived at the door. My mother answered it. "Would you be the young Mrs. McCann?" "Yes." "My name is Willie Hatton. I have been a client of your husband's for many years. Bit he has mortgaged me place field by field," said my mother. "I was in with him the other day. Says I to him, 'Mr. McCann, what about the wee garden at the back?' 'It's not worth the money,' he says. 'Just put it in the cart and throw it into me.' And here it is, Mrs. McCann." He tilted it up in the yard. When my father came home, he found my mother weeping. But the friendship between my father and that man Hatton lasted to the end when old Willie died. Now, my father, about 3 or 4 hours before he died, in the hospital, I was the only one with him, said to me, "Jack..." "Yes, father." "There's a bottle of brandy in that wardrobe." "Oh, get it out." And right enough there was, "yes." "Pour yourself a drink." "Yes, father." "And pour me a drink in a drinking cup, but water it down if you will." I did that. He was born in a pub, and he said to me, "Jack, they say you should go quiet and peaceful." I said, "Yes, father," not realizing what he was getting at. "That's the way they say you should go." "Well," he said, "Jack, in the name of God, we'll drink up and I'll go quiet and peaceful." He was saying farewell, and so will I. Good night. Earlier, I said farewell to my father. I'm quite sure if he and other Bellarmine solicitors to whom I've said farewell, Tom McAllister, Willie Shaw, Jam Steele, George Carruth, John Owens, Albert McClelland, Jim Bamber, James McCarville, Willie Curry, James L. Russell, Jim Owens, Sam Cumming, Sam Anderson, and my brother Frank, if they came back, they would say to me, "Carry on, Jack," and to Jim McKillop, "Play on, man."